Hi, John Cavanna. Welcome to KALU again.
Fantastic to be with you, Bill.
John Cavanna directed the large, influential Institute for Policy Studies for 20 years, is now a senior advisor at IPS. He knows Washington from the inside out, wrote some 12 books, the most recent co-author just released The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Save the Country from Corporate Greed. He's also worked in the trenches in environmental and poor people's movements. In this interview, John Cavanna analyzes the Biden American Jobs Plan, the multiple trillion-dollar proposal likely to pass in some form that functions as his administration's stimulus, a combination of goals, stimulus, COVID relief, and infrastructure program and jobs program. It features something for everyone, including many billions for the coal industry and nuclear power industries, and hundreds of billions for highways and bridges and for the auto industry in developing their clean green electric cars. Certainly when all the squabbling and fighting is over, when it gets through the Congress after the lobbyists do their work, U.S. corporations will be first in line for much of the funding. But that's only part of the story. The interview today also addresses whether left movements allied with the Congressional Progressive Caucus, can they sum up the will, the capacity to gain substantial funds, hundreds of billions actually, and use to demonstrate how to create programs to demonstrate how humankind can succeed through a radically democratic and just reconstruction of the way we produce, consume, and live. John Cavanna, tell us about Biden administration's American Jobs Plan.
Sure, and thank you, Bill. It's great to be with you. Just one word of context for the Biden plan that's so important and that all your listeners have been living. We've just been through 14 months of a global pandemic, which has turned the world on its head. So what used to be conventional wisdom for the preceding 50 years, I think it's probably smart for us to throw out the window. We're in a new ball game. Now, as you pointed out, we still have big corporate interests trying to get goodies out of the government. That hasn't changed. We still have Wall Street. We still have big military contractors. But I think for most people in this country and the world, we emerge from this pandemic with a bunch of new, radically different insights. The pandemic has exposed how incredibly unequal this country is. Both in class terms, we've watched the billionaires get $1.3 trillion richer in the pandemic, while ordinary workers have suffered. And also across race, we've watched black and brown workers be disproportionately hit both by the economic crisis and by COVID. And this has been apparent to everyone. And keep in mind, the pandemic follows a year of brilliant organizing in progressive circles around the climate emergency, the whole emergence of a climate youth movement. So we walk into this debate with Joe Biden, who's proposing some things, put some proposals on the table, I think with people having a much deeper sense that we have a government that for many years has favored fossil fuels over clean energy, that has favored Wall Street over Main Street, and less apparent but equally deep, a government that has favored the military with over half of its discretionary funding over basic human needs. So that's a strength. We walk into it, I think, with a country understanding the need for major change and wanting it. And by the way, that's part of what conditioned what Joe Biden has put on the table. I just want to remind all your listeners that last year, when Bernie Sanders pulled out of the race, he said, I'll pull out quietly if you agree to six major commissions between your people and my people. And out of that, there were months of fascinating debate on climate, on the economy, on health care, on other issues, where Bernie's people put forward the radical ideas that Bernie ran on, like the Green New Deal, and where the Biden people accepted a bunch of them. They accepted them. I don't know whether they believed in them or not. They knew that to win in the election, they needed the Bernie voters. So Joe Biden learned these issues. He learned the Green New Deal. He gave a major address on the need for that kind of transformation. He committed himself to it, and then he's elected. So we come into this year with Biden having made big promises. I think also the Biden people understand that this is a big transformative moment and that it needs big solutions. And so the plans he put forward are big and bold. They're bigger than anything that's been put forward by government ever before. It's a big jobs plan and what he calls the American Families Plan. These are hundreds of billions of dollars in investment in everything, as you say. I mean, everything's in there, you're right. So there's some bad stuff in there, like coal, like too much spending on highways and so on. And then there's some great stuff in there. A lot of money that will go into the energy transition, a lot of money that will go into jobs. The American Families Plan, a lot of money that will go into making child care affordable in this country, and in these plans, paying for them by taxing corporations and wealthy individuals. So getting at the imbalance, if you will, between Wall Street and Main Street. So I do want everybody to know that these are big, bold plans, and they include a lot of progressive priorities as well as some things that progressives won't like so much.
Yeah, I'm afraid, John, that as things go on, it's easy to make promises. It's even easy to spend $1 billion here and there on some small demonstration project that the left is seeking. I think, though, in this bargaining, we have to be very careful and also, as I pointed out, be very radical in supporting the Congressional Progressive Caucus, not just supporting them, but in fact making clear that they have to get together and carry their weight. And on the other hand, the Congress is made up of 400 or 500 people.
Right.
Maybe 100 of them are progressives. 400 are, in fact, the same people who have so enriched the companies in the past and dined with their lobbyists. I think it's going to be very hard, and especially with regard to climate change, it's going to be very hard to make sure that the package doesn't give such great funds to, for example, investor-owned utilities who really want to wipe out local democratic energy, have done everything they can and have not yet succeeded. But
right.
with congressional grants of enough money, they could build out their system so they could still dominate the American electrical, American power system, which is their goal. I think it's very worrisome when you think about the people who are making the decisions and the regulators who are making the decisions, who have shown themselves in the past to be very friendly to corporate interests, that we're going to, and there's not much time left, that we're going to see the U.S. response to climate change dominated by the people who really do not want to change their operations. It's the, you know, great growth over everything. Technology will save us.
Right.
And that gets us into what corporations, you have an inside seat on it as well for a long time, watching what goes on in congressional committees and the rest of it and how the sausage is made. It seems to me that the companies have changed their tune a lot in the last 5 or 10 years and really now, and they recognize that climate change is real and it will change everything, and they want that change of everything to make sure that they don't want to be the ones who lose out.
Right.
And it seems to me they have the power to really get a lot of things out of this Congress. Advanced nuclear is going to get money. The coal people are going to get money. The technology, Bill Gates' types who think technology can solve everything, just give it to the engineers and they'll solve it. You give it to the engineers and you get the military budget is when you get cost-plus contracts of bridges that can go nowhere and planes that have to be grounded after one test flight. I'm worried about that, John. And you've seen the corporate sector change. They really have responded. I think they've responded in ways to make sure that they can maintain control. Anyway, that's my hypothesis.
Okay, sure. So corporations, giant corporations have dominated the U.S. economy and American politics really since the 1970s when they went global and when they also developed huge lobbying operations in Washington, D.C. We have a street in Washington called K Street. And when you say K Street in Washington, everybody knows that it means corporate lobbyists. Each big corporation has literally hundreds of lobbyists. So corporations are big. And Bill, as you indicated, we're in an interesting period of shift. 20 years ago, when everybody saw that tobacco was killing millions of people around the world, what did the tobacco companies do? Did they go away? No, they transformed into food companies, and now they kill you through unhealthy food. A similar thing has been happening in the big corporate world of fossil fuels. So fossil fuel companies have dominated the U.S. scene since the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Huge companies, they are global, huge political clout in Washington. And yes, the science as of 20 years ago was so unquestionable that fossil fuels, if we continued to pull it out of the ground and use it at the rate we were, was going to destroy the planet. And even though corporations are short-term thinkers, they think mainly about their profits on a quarterly basis, 3 months from now, they were able to see that this would be the end of them within 10 to 15 years if they didn't adapt. The Institute for Policy Studies, my institute, has an interesting project in New Mexico. We bring some of the best creative minds from New Mexico to Washington. We work with groups there. And it is an incredible microcosm of this. It is a state built on the fossil fuel industry, oil and gas, also the military. And the oil and gas companies there see the handwriting on the wall. The legislature in New Mexico has said we need an energy transition. So who's doing the transition? It is big global corporations, some of them fossil fuel, some of them other new companies, some of them not even from the United States. They are coming in and saying, we can do solar, we can do wind, and we face a giant crisis of democracy around that. Will we allow giant corporations to dominate that industry in New Mexico and in this country? Or can we create rules that give advantage to the thousands of small-scale energy democracy experiments in this country, co-ops, other community-owned efforts to take energy back into the hands of people? And there are many of those, by the way, cropping up in a place like New Mexico. So you are absolutely right, Bill. The big corporations are now trying to game the system and slant the rules in their favor so that they get to become the next phase of America's energy future, but they do it with the same giant size, which has both corrupted our politics and created a very difficult imbalance between those corporations and their workers and the communities they're in. Now, that's their plan. Happily, there is resistance, and this is where we're at with Joe Biden. There will be more of the money in the Biden plan will go towards clean energy than towards the alternatives, including coal and nuclear, although it is absurd that they include nuclear as part of what's clean. More will go into what you and I and your listeners would agree is clean energy, but the big question is, can the rules be written in a way in which energy democracy is favored and has a chance to flourish? Or will the rules be written in a way that we simply are going to shift from big oil to big wind and big solar?
Yeah, I didn't know the New Mexico story. I do try and follow the California story, which is so fascinating. I've said it before on the air, over half the customers, electricity customers in California are now served by public agencies, when half of those half are served by the long-established public utilities, like in Los Angeles, the Department of Power and Water, Sacramento, San Francisco, and 40 others. The other half have developed in the last 10 years, pursuant to law, they have taken over the electric supply responsibility from PG&E and Southern California Edison, and they are now running the energy systems. The problem, of course, is the IOUs, PG&E, for example, investor-owned utilities, are fighting back. They're very strong in the legislature. They're extremely strong in the Public Utility Commission that makes decisions as to how much money the public agencies have to pay them for the use of their lines. They will not sell their lines. San Francisco has tried to buy their lines. They say, no, we're going to soak you for the use of our old lines, electric lines and grid. It seems to me there's this enormous struggle going on in California now between the corporate utilities and their bankers who are worldwide. Right. Corporate bonds are electricity bonds, are the gold standard in investing. Every rich person has utility bonds that pay 6 or 7%, and by law, they're guaranteed. Anyway, it seems to me that battle now As you pointed out, the battle is everywhere, but it's insufficiently in California. It's one of the least covered big stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, Bill, I mean, just if I could comment on this for a moment, you have highlighted one of the most important battles of the next 10 years. I think the interesting thing here is the public in the United States has been greatly awakened to a part of the problem, the part which is we need a rapid transition from fossil fuels to clean and renewable energy. They get that. The other big awakening of the country over the past year is that we need a resurgence of democracy in this country, but most people think of that purely in the political realm. We need voting rights for people who Republican legislatures are trying to take it away from. So there's a real sense we need a big energy transition. There's a real sense we need to hang on to and revitalize our democracy. We have to fight against right-wing attacks or attempts to curtail it at the state level. What I think will come in the next few years is a combining of these two. Most people just see the energy fight as that simple. Save the planet, reduce carbon emissions, do this transition. And what you're highlighting and what many people I know on the grassroots level are arguing for is we need democracy also in our energy sector. And I think that will emerge as we get more and more money that is going into the transition, as the transition speeds up. I think people who are instinctively people in this country are suspicious of big power, big concentrated power. And we've seen all of its problems in so many different spheres. I think as this transition speeds up, the voices of those who are putting forward alternative models of community-owned power and what we could loosely call energy democracy will gain in strength. And the battles that you are encouraging, Bill, I think will come to communities all over the country. It's not here yet, but we need to talk about it now in order to prepare the battles of, you know, 2022, 2023, and 2024. And we're up against a formidable opponent, these giant both fossil fuel firms, the nuclear firms, the coal firms, of course, and other big energy firms that are coming in. So it's going to take a huge amount of resolve. But I think the trick is, or the challenge here, is can we turn what is a massive democracy movement in this country, can we expand its notion of what democracy entails from just from voting rights and political democracy to economic democracy and energy democracy?
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to John Cavanaugh. We've discussed the Biden American Jobs Plan that promises something for everyone and seems to invite the U.S. corporate apparatus to fund, that gives it at least a great chance for the U.S. corporate apparatus to fund their own modernization plan with a clean and green gloss, to fund their plans with corporate money, which could, of course, be a death sentence for the planet. You've been right into the coming battle that's going to happen in the Congress over the American Jobs Plan. You're really familiar with, you're on the board, in fact, of the Progressive Caucus in Washington, the Congressional Progressive Caucus. It seems to me that our hope, and it's quite possible, is that the Congressional Caucus uses its leverage to make sure that a good deal of the money, in fact, goes to energy democracy. And that leads then to the question, how strong really are they? Can they be unified? To what extent are they in support of a variety of bills proposed by a number of senators and representatives? One of them is Jeff Merkley, who did quite a radical set of concepts, and the direction of the money would, in fact, go to energy democracy. Is the Congressional Progressive Caucus in support of Merkley and the others? Certainly some of the people are very strong and knowledgeable. Will they use their leverage, though? Tell us about that.
Sure. That's a great question, Bill, and it's an area of, I feel, great hope for progressives in this country. When Bernie Sanders was elected in 1991 as an independent congressman from Vermont, it was his idea to create a bloc that could create progressive power. So he was the creator of and first chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and it started with five people in 1991. It has grown to now 95 people at this moment, and it was given an amazing jolt of energy in these elections of sort of the Trump-inspired elections of progressives in 2018 and 2020. We got, in 2018, the squad, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley. We've got, in 2020, we got Cori Bush from Ferguson, and we got other progressives, great woman from New Mexico who is into energy democracy. We got three great progressives from New York State, and so on. So these are people, many of whom were organizers. The chair of the caucus is Pramila Jayapal from Washington State, from Seattle. She organized immigrant rights for many, many years. She also knows energy issues. She knows both labor and energy issues. She knows internationalist issues. She's committed to cutting the military budget. And coming out of organizing, she's a great organizer of this caucus. Now, the other thing they have on their side, so it's 95 members coming together around a very progressive agenda, Green New Deal, massive jobs plan, union rights, transforming our care economy in one that works for both parents with young kids as well as workers in that sphere. The other thing they have going for them is that what they're pushing for is very popular. So overwhelmingly, people want these big things we've just been talking about. And not only that, this is a new moment, I think, in U.S. politics. People are so mad that billionaires made money off the pandemic and that corporations paid their CEOs record amounts last year in a pandemic that these proposals are even more popular when you link them to taxing the rich and taxing corporations. So the Progressive Caucus, backed by a lot of progressive groups, are also pushing a very strong redistributive taxing of Wall Street, the wealthy, and corporations that would hit at the core of the inequality problem in this country. So that's the good news. Now, your specific question is, will they be good on the energy transition and on energy democracy? I want to say my sense of it is that about a third of them really know these issues. And this is in thanks to the Sunrise Movement. Many people will remember this, the moment when those great progressives were elected, AOC being the fourth member of the squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. One of her first acts was to join Sunrise. This is 2018. She stood up on a desk in Nancy Pelosi's office and waved the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is also, and the groups pushing it all over the country are for energy democracy. She got it instinctually. She quickly became the most popular, if you will, and most followed member of that Congressional Progressive Caucus, along with Pramila Jayapal and the others. And so a huge amount of education has been done since 2018. And then you mentioned in the Senate counterparts would be Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and Jeff Merkley and a handful of others. These are people who've been greatly schooled. And I really want to give credit to the progressive movements that have turned more of their attention towards these elected officials and towards educating them. So Merkley does understand it. So do the progressives. Now, can they fight hard against the giant corporate interests when in the middle of the night? I mean, this is the way Congress works. This big bill will be put together, and in the last 24 hours, the corporate people will be in there lobbying. And now there's a counterpart, which is progressive groups and the caucus also pushing hard. And yes, I think on a number of the energy democracy issues, the progressives will draw a line in the sand and say these must be in there for us to vote for them. So I'm hopeful that some will get in there. And I'm also, though, I just want to say this is why your radio show is so important. We need a lot more education on the energy democracy issues. So your work is critical on this, and all of the groups in the Climate Justice Alliance and other groups that are pushing for this. There's a Thrive Network that's pushing for Green New Deal-like legislation. We need to do massive education with the public to get them. They're at phase one. They know we need a major energy transition. We now need to get more of them to phase two to understand that this must be done democratically.
John Cavanaugh, thanks so much for talking to us. I hope in the next several months when this bill gets cobbled together that we'll come out of it with the resources that can show the planet and the people in the United States the use of those resources for demonstration projects of energy democracy, like in California and New Mexico, apparently, and Massachusetts. They're primed for it. That can show really the way to reduce fulminating climate roasting and save an inhabitable planet. John Cavanaugh, so good talking to you, and keep up the good work, and put your muscle to the grindstone, or whatever you're supposed to do.
No, thanks so much, Bill, and the same to you. You are educating the public, and we're working in coalition with many groups to push these things, and we reinforce one another. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you today.